Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. On today's programme, the EU stands up to Washington over the Iran nuclear deal, protests against the Austrian government's anti-immigration agenda, remote control. Could the leader of Spanish region Catalonia govern in absentia?
It's almost fitting that we're talking about such an unusual mechanism as trying to govern via Skype. You know, it's completely fitting with this unusual situation that Catalonia finds itself in.
And how the French region of Brittany is keeping a close eye on events unfolding in Catalonia. These stories and more coming up on the programme. This week marked the second anniversary of the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal that loosens sanctions on Tehran in exchange for curbs on its nuclear programme. Germany, Britain, and France are among the signatories, along with the US and Russia. But as Terry Schultz reports from Brussels, US President Donald Trump has said he wants to kill the agreement that Europe says is working to keep the world safer.
The European Union and United States are on a collision course over the Iran nuclear deal, an agreement the EU says has worked to stop Iran from continuing to develop a nuclear weapon. But U.S. President Donald Trump says he will no longer support the nuclear agreement, which he's famously called one of the worst ever signed by the U.S. Trump just approved a waiver of sanctions against Tehran, a key component of the agreement, but he said it was the last time, which means in 4 months the U.S. could effectively pull out and the agreement would almost certainly be dead. The U.S. wants the EU to join it in including the nuclear deal as part of its wider policy goals on Iran, curbing ballistic missile development and increasing freedom for Iranian citizens. Europe shares those concerns but wants to deal with the issue separately. Foreign ministers of Germany, France, and Britain met EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini and their Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif, in Brussels to discuss what to do next. Mogherini emphasized the agreement's effectiveness.
The deal is working. It is delivering on its main goal, which means keeping the Iranian nuclear program in check and under close surveillance. The European Union remains committed to support the full and effective implementation of the agreement, including to make sure that the lifting of nuclear-related sanctions has a positive impact on trade and economic relations with Iran, including benefits for the Iranian people. The agreement has allowed for deeper cooperation and continuous dialogue with Iran on all issues.
Aiming his remarks at Trump, German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel said Europe would protect the agreement, regardless of who is attacking it.
We want to protect the JCPOA against every possible undermining decision from which side it may come. So we know that it's absolutely necessary to have these signal that it's possible by diplomatic approaches to prevent the development of nuclear weapons in a time where other parts of the world are discussing how to get nuclear weapons into force, and it would send a very dangerous signal to the rest of the world if the only agreement which prevents us from the proliferation of nuclear weapons would be a negative effect.
British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson added his own message for Trump about tearing down the deal.
I don't think anybody has so far produced a better alternative to the JCPOA as a way of preventing the Iranians from going ahead with the acquisition of a military nuclear capability. I don't think anybody has come up with a better idea. And I think it's incumbent on those who oppose the JCPOA really to come up with that better solution, because we haven't seen it so far.
That doesn't sit well with the White House, which sent out Vice President Mike Pence to blast not just the Iranian government, but European ones as well, for what he portrayed as a reluctance to criticize Iranian leadership over its response to the recent demonstrations. The U.S. has spoken clearly and unequivocally, Pence wrote in an op-ed in the Washington Post. Unfortunately, many of our European partners, as well as the United Nations, have thus far failed to forcefully speak out on the growing crisis in Iran. It's time for them to stand up. Iran expert Eli Garanmaya agrees the EU should stand up more to Washington.
Garen Maya, a senior policy fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations, called the Trump approach ridiculous for putting at risk an agreement that the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, regularly confirms is being fulfilled by Iran. U.S. journalist Jay Solomon, author of a book on Iran and a fellow at the Washington Institute, says the EU should expect to pay an economic price if it does not show what the White House considers more backbone when it comes to Iranian actions. He says the U.S. could, for example, block planned future sales of aircraft to Iran by Boeing and Airbus, which would cost Europe plenty. Or it could reimpose U.S. sanctions on companies doing business in Iran, restrictions loosened when the nuclear deal was concluded.
U.S. law essentially is anything that has more than 20% American content needs a waiver from an office inside Treasury called OFAC. So he decides not to issue those waivers. Those sales can't go ahead. The sense I've gotten from the White House is they are not inclined to issue those waivers. I do see that as a real point of tension.
Garen Maya points out that European governments shouldered the financial burden of international sanctions against Iran before, when their holdings there were much greater. She asserts they'd be willing to do so again, if convinced this is necessary to curb Tehran's behavior. But at the moment, there's little common ground on these questions, and all sides agree EU-U.S. relations over Iran are headed for some very difficult times. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Austria's new government is getting down to business. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz was in Berlin this week for talks with German leader Angela Merkel. But back home, his right-wing populist coalition partner, the Freedom Party, was making embarrassing headlines. Kerry Skyring reports from Vienna.
The swearing-in a month ago of Austria's new government, a coalition of the Conservative People's Party and the far-right Freedom Party. The last time the country saw such a coalition was 18 years ago. Back then, the European Union imposed diplomatic sanctions because the Freedom Party was seen as too extreme. Many Austrians agreed. There were huge street protests that continued for days. This time, the protesters are fewer in number, although they still carry "No Nazis" placards, a reference to the fact that the Freedom Party was founded by former Nazis. And this time around, there are no European Union sanctions, but rather cautious optimism that Chancellor Sebastian Kurz will keep his promise to lead a pro-European government playing a constructive role in the EU. It's a promise he might find hard to keep, given the record of his coalition partner and the deal he's made with it. The Freedom Party controls the defence and foreign ministries and the interior ministry, with responsibility for security and immigration. The agreement includes cuts to public spending, taxes, and benefits for asylum seekers. And before the government was even 1 month old, the Freedom Party was providing embarrassing headlines. At a press conference to highlight a drop in asylum applications, the new far-right interior minister, Herbert Kickl, said this.
I want infrastructure that will allow authorities to concentrate asylum seekers in one place.
Concentration camps were the death camps in which the Nazis concentrated millions of Jews and other persecuted groups during the Holocaust. Opposition parties and media commentators saw the use of the term in connection with refugee camps as a deliberate provocation. Herbert Kickl denies this. The political scientist and pollster Peter Filzmaier says even if it was a mistake,
at the very least, it was not clever. It was insensitive and it was irresponsible. But leaving aside this incident, the Freedom Party and Kickl himself have often consciously been provocative with their statements on asylum seekers.
And so, with his coalition partner already raising doubts about its fitness for office, Chancellor Kurz is under scrutiny in European capitals like Paris, Rome and Berlin. His first foreign rendezvous was with French President Emmanuel Macron, a successful campaigner against right-wing populism in his own country. Macron says Kurz is leading a pro-European government, and the two young leaders appear to have much in common. But their priorities for Europe differ. Macron is pushing economic reform, while Kurz seeks tougher migration and asylum policies, something he stressed at their joint press conference in Paris.
The European Union ohne Grenzen nach innen wird nur funktionieren, wenn es
the European Union will only be able to function without internal borders when there are secure external borders. Austria is a pro-European country. We have a pro-European government, which would like to actively work together to create a better Europe.
full military honours for Sebastian Kurz as he arrived in Berlin this week. Germany is Austria's most important trading partner and closest ally. But criticism of Angela Merkel and her immigration policies was a central platform of the Austrian Chancellor's election campaign. Mrs. Merkel made clear her reservations about Mr. Kurz's choice of coalition partner.
We will judge the new Austrian government by its deeds, and that's what I told the Chancellor. That's what counts. Certainly we'll observe more closely than otherwise would be the case, but what counts are the deeds.
And according to political scientist Reinhard Heinisch, there is the potential for tension between Vienna and Berlin.
In the way Kurz creates his political message, Europe becomes the enemy, Europe becomes in part the antagonist. So it's a ticket against Europe to some extent. In Merkel and Macron, it's a different approach. We need to work with Europe. So there is the potential of a split, and you could see Austria moving closer to the countries of Central Europe that are more Euro-skeptical on those issues, and they want a reduced role of the European Union. And Kurz may add to those voices, and that could drive a wedge between Germany and Austria.
Despite their differences, Merkel and Kurz made much of their desire for close cooperation at their meeting this week. For Angela Merkel, though, that also means keeping a close eye on Austria's swing to right-wing populism. Kerry Skyring, DW, Vienna.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Lawmakers in the Spanish region of Catalonia have elected a pro-independence speaker as a new regional parliament met for the first time since it was dissolved by Madrid. That's said to be their first step to return former regional president Carles Puigdemont to power. He fled to Belgium in October to avoid arrest after he was fired by the Spanish Prime Minister for leading Catalonia's independence bid. The Catalan Parliament is expected to vote for a new leader at the end of January. The region's two main independence parties say they will back Puigdemont, but he is still in exile in Belgium. And therein lies the issue. Our Madrid correspondent, Guy Hedgeco, is with me. Hello, Guy.
Hi there, Keith.
What is the dilemma for Puigdemont?
Well, the dilemma for Puigdemont is to decide whether or not he is going to present himself as the candidate to be invested as president of Catalonia at the end of January, which is the deadline for the candidate to present himself. Now, if he does so, either he has to return to Catalonia, return to Spain, and he would face almost certain arrest if he did so, because he faces these charges of sedition and rebellion from the Spanish authorities. And so he would almost certainly be jailed if he did return. So if he doesn't, he has to try and become president via either video link, is one option that his people are looking at, or via some kind of delegate or representative, someone to substitute him in the Catalan Parliament. That is, to read out a speech on his behalf and to represent him as a physical presence there. Now, the problem there is that the Spanish government has said that if he does try to do that, if he does try to become invested from afar, it will appeal against that investiture before the Constitutional Court. And it will also refuse to remove this direct rule, which has been in place since the end of October in Catalonia.
So will he return or will he not? Is there an actual legal position? Is there something written down that says that you must be present or that you can do it by video link?
Well, what the law says regarding the investiture of a regional president is that he or she must appear before the chamber, that is, before the regional parliament. So those words, before the chamber, are, you would think, rather specific, but they have been interpreted in different ways. You know, people on Puigdemont's side are saying, well, that in this day and age, that can mean you can appear before the chamber, virtually or digitally, via Skype, for example.
We've heard of this happening in courts all over Europe, court appearances by video link. People have been using Skype for business meetings for the past 10 or 15 years. So technology has moved things on.
Well, Yeah, well, one of the arguments that Puigdemont's allies have made is making a comparison with the United States. They say the president of the United States is, you know, he's often in Washington, and most of the time he's in Washington, and yet he is president of this huge territory, much of which he doesn't, you know, get to see, or he's not present there. So they use that comparison. I mean, that hasn't convinced opponents of this idea, the pro-union politicians and parties, who say it's absurd. They say you can't have a president of a territory who is not there, who's governing by Skype.
And is there going to be a decision made on that? Is somebody going to say, look, you can do it via Skype or via video link?
Well, the moment we have is the non-binding ruling or the non-binding advice of the legal experts of the Catalan Parliament. They say you can't do that, but it's non-binding. Now, what it might come to is simply that he tries to do it, and then the Spanish government appeals against it before the Constitutional Court. The feeling is that the Constitutional Court would rule against Puigdemont in this case. In that case, it would be deemed illegal. So that's one possibility. But Puigdemont might simply back down at the last moment and choose someone else to replace him, someone less divisive, someone who doesn't have all the sort of legal baggage weighing them down, and who could simply turn up at the Catalan Parliament, be invested as a normal president would, and become the new president.
And would Puigdemont be pulling the strings behind the scene if that situation were to happen?
Well, you would think so. I mean, there are two main political parties who are handling this at the moment. It's Puigdemont's own PDCAT party, which was the leading pro-independence party in the elections. And then there's the Catalan Republican Left. They both have a similar number of seats in the parliament, but they're working very closely together on this. So they're kind of partners. And whatever decision there is, they both have to agree on it. So I think both those parties will have a big say in this. But obviously, Puigdemont is the sort of very influential figure looking over all of this. And there is a possibility that he might even return to Barcelona for the investiture. You know, a very dramatic grand move, which would see him arrested, no doubt. But it would perhaps put a pressure on the Spanish authorities, because then he could say, well, you're oppressing us. You're not even allowing me to be invested as president when I've been voted by the Catalan people.
Is there any way he can return to Barcelona without being arrested?
I think the only way would be if he did it sort of secretly. And, you know, I say that, but he did manage to do that previously when he fled to Belgium. He left Catalonia. He told very few people, even his own people didn't seem to know about it in his own party, many of them. He took a car across the border to Marseille and then took a flight to Brussels. So he could try and do that again. The problem for him this time is the authorities will be much more alert.
So he could, for example, as there is some speculation, he could sneak in and seek diplomatic immunity in a foreign consulate in Barcelona.
That is a possibility. I mean, obviously, the big question there is which consulate would it be? Because that would then put a great deal of pressure on the government of that embassy to take him in, and that would create tensions between that country's government and Spain, no doubt. But it's certainly a possibility. And as we've seen with this Catalan issue, I mean, anything is really possible.
Our Madrid correspondent Guy Hedgecoe there. Thank you very much, Guy.
Thanks a lot, Keith. It's a pleasure.
Europe has many other secessionist and autonomous movements keeping an eye on Catalonia. Brittany in the northwest of France has seen a huge rise of enthusiasm for the regional Breton culture in recent years. Many show little enthusiasm for the nationalist politics that get so many people fired up in Scotland, the Basque Country or Flanders. But some now believe that independence for Brittany is just a matter of time. This report from John Lawrenson in the Breton town of Vannes.
Arriving at the rehearsal of the Vannes Bagad, or Breton Pipe Band, where the conductor is trying to fit a Breton folk melody over Latin drums. This 50-strong Bagad starts rehearsals split into instrument groups, some you might recognise, some you might not. Joan Lorette is musical director.
Le mouvement Bagad est né dans les années 40, à partir des années 40.
The Bagad movement started in the 1940s. We wanted to imitate our Scottish cousins. So we created pipe bands like Scottish pipe bands, but with a Breton twist. So we imported snare drums and bagpipes and added our own instrument, a bit like an oboe, called the bombard. When I started playing in a Bagad, most of the musicians were old. In fact, people considered the whole idea old-fashioned. That has completely changed. It's become really popular.
There are now 130 Bagadou, full of young people. Like being part of the football team, belonging to the Bagad gives you a sense of community. But it's also and always about being Breton. This young piper, for example, who was christened François Grimaud, but who now goes by the Breton equivalent of his first name, Fonch.
Dans ma famille, c'est vrai qu'il y a toujours eu...
My family's always been really attached to Breton traditions. My grandparents played in the René Bagad in the 50s or 60s or something, and we joke about going to France when we leave Brittany. But for some of us, there is something serious there, like an affirmation that this is our music, this is who we are.
In Paris, I go to visit a man for whom the Breton cultural revival is just the beginning.
Bonsoir. Hi. Nice to meet you.
Gilles Martin Chauffier is the editor of Paris Match magazine and the author of several novels and a history of Brittany. Breton nationalism, let alone separatism, is a negligible political force. Nationalist parties get 1 or 2% of the Breton vote. But Martin Chauffier's new book is called The Happiness of Being Breton, The Regions Against the Nations, in which he applauds the Catalan initiative and predicts Breton independence.
A number of regions with a high level of personality are suddenly considering that what happens in Catalonia might happen elsewhere. A few years ago, you thought if you are Scottish, if you want independence, you will have to leave England and Europe. And that's what Brussels said, if you leave England, you will leave Europe. What is happening now in Catalonia is that Brussels never said to Catalonia, if you leave Spain, you will leave Europe. Spain has told it, but Brussels did not confirm it.
There are lots of nations within nations in Europe, and Brittany probably has one of the strongest identities of all of these nations within nations. But compare Brittany to Catalonia or Basque Country or Scotland or Flanders, whatever. The will towards independence seems almost non-existent. It's almost as if that is the sort of defining characteristic of this nation within a nation. It's not interested in nationhood.
Yes. Presently, it's true that Brittany doesn't want to leave France. But when they will see that Catalonia, that Flanders, that Venice, that Corsica, that Scotland will become independent, the idea necessarily is going to emerge.
But if it might one day, it hasn't yet at the Bagad de Vannes, in any case, where the people I talk to make a clear distinction between affirming Breton identity and willing the rebirth of an independent Breton nation. Playing the bombard is first of all about playing Breton music and defending Breton culture generally. Young musician Marine Lestrade tells me, do you consider yourself a nationalist? I ask her.
No.
John Lawrenson, DW, Vannes.
You're listening to Inside Europe. If you'd like to get in touch with the team here, you can email us at europe@dw.com. We'd love to hear from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. In the next half an hour, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan threatens to strangle a planned 30,000-strong US-backed force in Syria. The broken dreams of Europeans who head to Germany for a better life.
Wenn Sie kommen nach Deutschland, dann kommen Sie nach Deutschland mit Hoffnung, um Arbeit zu bekommen, Geld zu verdienen.
They come to Germany hoping to find a job, but that hardly ever works out, and they start drinking, because you can't survive on the streets without alcohol.
Also on Inside Europe, an army of so-called elves fighting an information war in Lithuania, and Italian artisans turn high-tech to keep traditions alive. Stay tuned for those stories and more. The US-led coalition is training some of its militia allies to be part of a new force of 30,000 troops in Syria. One of the areas the force will patrol is the border with Turkey, which is controlled by Syrian Kurdish Alliance, the YPG. But Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is angry about the plan and has threatened to strangle the planned US-backed force before it's even born. Our Istanbul correspondent Dorian Jones is with me now. Hello, Dorian. What's the border force looking to achieve?
Well, according to Washington, they say this is crucial to bringing stability to this large part of Syria, which borders not only Turkey, but Iraq as well. US-backed forces of the Syrian Kurdish militia and other forces within the region have eradicated broadly, mostly the presence of Islamic State. But they say going forward, there is need for stability and also to prevent the threat of remaining Islamic State forces seeping across into Iraq and into Turkey. So they see this very much as crucial to bring stability to this region. But beyond that, I think critics and observers also say that this is part of Washington's wider game plan of maintaining influence and control in at least part of Syria as the process of bringing an end to this civil war goes forward. This is very much seen as Washington keeping its presence in Syria, given the fact that it has this ongoing rivalry with Iranian forces and Russia as well.
And why is Turkey angry about the new border force?
Well, because a large part of this force will be made up of the Syrian Kurdish militia, the YPG. Now, they have been key allies with Washington in defeating the Islamic State in Syria. But according to Ankara, they say this militia is linked to the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which has been waging a decades-long insurgency inside Turkey. They see, according to Ankara, no difference between the YPG and the PKK. They refer to them as terrorists. And in fact, the Turkish president has referred to the creation of this Syrian border force as a terrorism army, and he has pledged to eradicate it before it even gets off the ground.
And Erdogan has said that they want to launch a military assault very, very shortly, and he wants the US to support the operation. How is that going to affect things?
Well, I think that already relations between Ankara and Washington over Washington's support of this Syrian Kurdish militia has plunged bilateral ties to record lows. In fact, many people see this as unprecedented, the current tensions. And in fact, the President Erdogan gave an ultimatum to Washington. He warned that any US forces with the Syrian Kurdish militia, when Turkey carries out this operation, he said that they will be buried along with the militants. Now, this is seen as a threat directly to US forces, but it has to be said at the moment, the key objective, at least the initial objective of Turkish forces in any operation into Syria, is aimed at the Afrin enclave. Now, this is the one enclave where there are no US forces present. And in fact, Washington has said that what happens in Afrin isn't their affair. They say they have no interest there. Where there is a presence is Russian forces. Now, Russia is also backing the Syrian Kurdish militia, and they have deployed Russian soldiers to prevent previous threats by Turkey to launch operations into this enclave. Now, this potentially puts Ankara on a collision course, not only with Washington, but also directly with Moscow as well. Now,
there was a similar situation as Afrin last year in March. Manbij, which is a similar enclave, another Kurdish-controlled area, which is also, both of these areas are about 30 miles, about 40 kilometres from the Turkish border. Then, back in March last year, Turkey said it would capture Manbij if the US didn't clear out the Kurdish fighters who controlled it. Is this situation repeating itself in Afrin?
Well, you are right. I mean, the Turkish president has repeatedly made these threats, not only against Afrin, but as you say, Manbij as well. And many people see this as in domestic rhetoric. This hard stance against Washington plays very well with the Turkish nationalist supporters, which are a key constituent of the president, as does facing down what they see as the Kurdish terrorist threat as well. So these threats in the past have been broadly dismissed as just domestic rhetoric. But this time, I think the threat is being taken far more serious. That's because Turkey has been building up large amounts of forces on the Syrian border, close to this Afrin enclave. And there is genuine outrage in Ankara for the feeling that Washington didn't even consult Turkey before taking this very dramatic step of creating this 30,000-strong defense force. There is feelings that Washington is ignoring Turkey. Now, Turkey has the largest border with Syria. It has 3 million Syrian refugees. Ankara considers it has a major interest in what's going on in this region. It feels that Washington is ignoring them. And in fact, the president recently said that he spoke with Donald Trump and Trump promised to get back to him. He said he never rang back. He said he will not pick up the telephone again. He very much feels he's being slighted. And going forward, there is this feeling in Ankara that as we approach the end game, the resolving of the Syrian civil war, Ankara feels it's being squeezed out, not only by Washington, but also by Moscow. So this tough stance is many ways sending a warning to both these major players that Turkey too has a role and Turkey can make life very difficult for all concerned.
And what role is Russia playing around the Afrin region?
Well, Russia does have this military presence in Afrin. There's even been reports that Turkish artillery bombardment of this region came very close to a Russian military base. And in many ways, Russia also has a key role to play because Russia, through its very sophisticated surface-to-air missile system in the region, controls the airspace. Now, if Turkey was to launch this operation to Afrin, and most people consider it would be an extremely difficult operation, given it's a very mountainous region, the Syrian Kurdish militia have been entrenched there for many years. They've been waiting for this operation to come, so they are ready to put up a very stiff fight. Now, this Turkish operation would largely be seen to be dependent on air support. Now, air support would only be possible with Moscow's permission. And for now, at least, Moscow seems very reluctant to give that permission. And in fact, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has warned that they've said to Ankara that they hope that Ankara maintains its commitment to not get involved in Afrin.
And what's Turkey's end game in this area?
Well, I think that beyond what Ankara sees is removing this threat from this Syrian Kurdish militia, it's more about establishing its voice in the ongoing process to resolve Syria. Now, this Syrian civil war has really had a very profound effect on Turkey. A large 3 million or so Syrian refugees, threats from Islamic State terrorism attacks. Ankara really believes it has a vested interest in what happens in the future of Syria, and it wants its voice to be heard.
Okay, Dorian Jones there, our Istanbul correspondent. This is Inside Europe. The number of homeless people in Germany has risen dramatically in recent years. Aid organisations say about 860,000 people do not have roofs over their heads. Most, of course, are Germans. But the situation is particularly dire for people from other European countries that are coming here looking for jobs and then ending up on the streets. They're not entitled to welfare or social housing, and their numbers are also rising. Many homeless charities say they're overwhelmed by the number of people looking for help. From Berlin, Daniel Pels reports.
It's a freezing Saturday night in the German capital, Berlin. Afa Daga and Rudolf Canali are driving their blue van through the rain and the biting wind. They are on the lookout for people sleeping rough. The two work for the Stadtmission, a local Christian charity. Their van is one of several that ply the streets of Berlin in winter. According to Arthur, most of Berlin's homeless are Germans, but an increasing number of them come from other European countries like Poland, Romania and Bulgaria.
In die Länder, die wird immer schwieriger, in ganze Europa die schwieriger.
Life is getting more difficult in many countries. The gap between the rich and the poor is widening. When people are hungry and they have no work, they start looking for a place where they can earn some money. Germany has a good reputation in Europe, and that's why many people come here.
We're from the church called Stadtmission. We have tea.
The two stop to talk to a man sleeping on the street. A green sleeping bag is his only protection from the winter chill. Empty beer bottles and plastic shopping bags litter the pavement around him. Arthur and Rudolf offer to take him to a shelter for the night. But the man, who's from England, isn't keen. Arthur and Rudolf turn their efforts to another homeless man nearby. He's called Thelius and came to Berlin from Greece in the hope of a better life.
Ich hatte einen Fall in Griechenland und danach Stroh.
I had an accident, and after that, a heart attack. I didn't have any money or a job in Greece, so I came to live in Germany. I worked here for a while, but I went back to Greece, and then the crisis hit, and I had problems. I wouldn't be able to survive in Greece right now. I don't have anyone there.
Thelios also doesn't want a lift to the homeless shelter. There are too many alcoholics causing trouble there, he says. He'll stay in his square, where he's been sleeping next to a public toilet for the last 2.5 years. Thelius survives by collecting bottles from the garbage and cashing them in. He's also received free medical treatment from Berlin's University Hospital. He wouldn't get this kind of care back home in Greece, he says. But this doesn't mean his life in Germany is easy.
Ich bin ein bisschen krank noch. Dafür kann ich arbeiten. Ich habe das versucht.
I'm still a bit sick and I can't work. I tried to work in a supermarket, but I had too much pain. I hope I'll get better.
Kältebus der Stadtmission Berlin, Herr Ali, guten Abend.
The team's mobile phone rings. A woman has found a homeless man on the street and wants directions to the closest emergency shelter. After dealing with the call, Arthur explains that the dreams of foreigners like Thelius usually don't work out.
Wenn sie kommen nach Deutschland, da kommen sie nach Deutschland mit Hoffnung, um Arbeit zu bekommen, Geld zu verdienen.
They come to Germany hoping to find a job, so they can earn enough money to survive and also to send to their families back home. But that hardly ever works out, and they start drinking, because you can't survive on the streets without alcohol.
Germany does have a welfare system and offers assistance to homeless people. But those that come here from outside Germany aren't eligible for most benefits, such as welfare payments or public housing. This doesn't seem to put people off trying their luck in the German capital. Tents and makeshift shelters are now a familiar sight in parks and under railway bridges. Politicians have started complaining that the situation is out of control. Franziska Giffey, the mayor of Berlin's Neukölln district, told national broadcaster Deutschlandfunk that it's too much.
Sometimes we have a situation where 10, 20 or even 30 people set up camp in a park or recreational area and spend their nights there. But that leads to all sorts of issues. There's garbage and people relieve themselves in the open. Obviously, the residents then get angry because they don't want to see these places degenerating like that.
City authorities have cleared some camps in recent months. They insist that they are not simply chasing away the homeless and that they offer assistance to those in the camps. This is impossible to verify, though, as authorities denied a request from Deutsche Welle to watch the evictions. Back at the Stadtmission van, Arthur and Rudolf have found an elderly Polish man sleeping outside. They'll take him to a shelter where he can have a bed for the night. A big problem is that these winter shelters are only open from November to March. Outside of this period, most of the homeless people are forced back onto the city streets. Arthur says authorities in Germany and other European countries need to cooperate to find long-term solutions for Berlin's homeless foreigners.
Viele sind so krank geworden, dass sie können nirgendwo Arbeit bekommen.
We need more assistance so that people can return home. Many are so sick that they have no chance of finding work anymore. After all, we live in the European Union, so it should be possible to organize for them to go home and to find them somewhere to stay or a place in an institution where they can spend their remaining years.
Frankfurt, Gambacher Kreuz, dann nach Norden, Heiger Burbach, Sauerlandlinie.
But until that happens, Arthur and his colleagues will drive through Berlin's streets every night throughout winter, trying to make the life of the city's homeless a little easier. Daniel Pelz, Deutsche Welle, Berlin.
Our next story takes us to Lithuania, where the government has long voiced concerns that Russia is allegedly using cyber attacks and fake news to lay the groundwork for an eventual invasion of the country. Our reporter Anna-Sophia Hoffman-Schroeder went to Lithuania to the front line of the information war, where she met an informal internet army of Lithuanians who are fighting what they describe as pro-Russian propaganda and online trolls.
In the shadow of a linden tree in a peaceful park in Vilnius, 44-year-old Ričardas Savukynas sits in the grass bending over his laptop. He's on a defense mission. Ričardas works as a business consultant, but he's also a volunteer in a rapidly growing internet resistance movement. They call themselves the Lithuanian Elves because they fight pro-Russian trolls online, he explains with a smile.
Trolls are bad and they are from Russia, from Kremlin. And who fights trolls? Elves.
The Lithuanian Elves patrol social media entries to find and expose fake accounts and pro-Russian trolls, and they coordinate their campaign via Facebook and Skype.
We can do lots of fact-checking, we can search for different information sources, not only about Russia, but about all the things which are important for Lithuania.
While sitting in the grass, Ričardas reports a profile on Facebook which has been spreading fake news and hate speech about Lithuanian politicians. He shares his disclosure on Facebook with fellow elves to alert them about yet another source of misinformation. The elves started as a grassroots movement 3 years ago when Russia annexed Crimea in 2014. Ričardas Savukynas was part of the movement from the beginning and many others have joined since then.
I would say that total amount of people who are involved in fact-checking, in fake account reporting, in real information spread is around 5,000.
He and his fellow volunteers are concerned that the increasing pro-Russian propaganda, denying the rights of Baltic states to exist, could prepare the ground for a physical invasion. After all, in Ukraine, Russian propaganda justifying historic claims started more than a decade before the invasion of Crimea began. Ričardas Savukynas wants to protect his country.
I do something for my country, so it means I do something for myself. My own safety, for safety of my family and friends and other people around me.
At the Lithuanian Ministry of Defense in Vilnius, Sergeant Thomas Oponis from the military's Department of Strategic Communication explains that his team is monitoring the Russian information activities in Lithuania, both online and in TV broadcasts.
The most visible Russian activities in our area is definitely through Russian TV channels. We see that new internet news pages were open in order to message for our society. Also, we see how much newspapers in Russian language and how much radio programs we have. So this stuff we really can count. And here we see that we have more and more of these activities.
Over the last decade, the broadcast time of Russian TV on Lithuanian networks has more than doubled, from 79 hours weekly in 2007 to 198 hours this year. Sergeant Thomas Oponis explains that many of the stories broadcast from Russian TV or on social media question Lithuania's right to exist as an independent country and support claims of Lithuanian territories. For years, several Russian politicians like MP Vladimir Zhirinovsky have talked about a Russian invasion of the Baltic countries on Lithuanian TV networks, like this speech from 2013.
All Baltic states shall be occupied and then destroyed because there are rockets that can reach Moscow in 5 minutes.
Savukynas explains that the Russian propaganda often targets Lithuania's problems with immigration, a demographical crisis, the energy sector and income equality, and this way tries to mock Lithuania by stating that independence from Russia, as well as EU membership, only brought depopulation and economic instability. And since NATO decided on the deployment of troops in response to growing nervousness over the Kremlin's aggressive behavior, there have been an increase in fake news about NATO, Saponis says.
Their hostile narrative is that NATO overall is a danger, that all bad things are coming from the NATO, and that NATO is trying to encircle Russia.
The Lithuanian authorities try to counter the pro-Russian propaganda, Thomas Saponis explains.
We are trying to use our national laws in order to fight Russian disinformation campaign. And here we already have some success. We were able to punish some Russian TV channels on a very clear disinformation event or very open propaganda cases. So we have more than 10 cases already in Lithuania. And we're going to continue these activities.
And Saponis says every Lithuanian citizen should be able to distinguish between fake news and historic facts to be able to judge what's going on.
I think our citizens, they are part of informational environment from very young age. And our youngsters, they are living in social media and YouTube and in other platforms. So, but before acting in these areas, they have to receive training.
According to a recent survey in Lithuania, some 26% of Lithuanians agreed with the statement that life in the Soviet Union was better than in current Lithuania. The positive view of the Soviet past was strongest among elderly people, people with lower education, the Russian and Polish communities in Lithuania, and among those who experienced substantial loss of incomes after 1990. Also, the survey proved a direct relationship between a positive attitude towards the Soviet past and the exposure to the Russian media. In front of Vilnius Cathedral lies the magic stone. The small stone marks the human chain, which was formed in 1989 across the three Baltic states, demonstrating their desire for independence from the Soviet Union, which Lithuania gained in 1990. Looking out over the cathedral square, the 43-year-old mayor of Vilnius, Remigijus Simašius, explains that many older Lithuanians feel a nostalgia for the Soviet era and hence are easier targets for propaganda.
I speak English, it's okay, but you know, I speak Russian as well. And in my childhood, I saw like Russian cartoons and many of Russian culture, and part of it was like socialistic propaganda.
The mayor himself is also part of the resistance movement, the Lithuanian Elves. Many Lithuanians feel a need to do their bit to protect their country, he says.
10 or 15 years ago, it was a perception very, very widespread in Lithuania that, you know, we are now under NATO shield and we are safe and we don't have to care. Somehow we have to contribute to like overseas actions of NATO and that's it. Now the understanding is completely different, that we have to contribute ourselves, both as Lithuania, as a country, to the NATO joint forces, and as citizens to national defense forces. Defense in all means, in anti-propaganda defense and anti-cyber attack defense, and also as military protection.
For Deutsche Welle, I'm Anne-Sophie Hoffmann-Schröder in Vilnius, Lithuania.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. For decades, hundreds of small family-owned businesses and traditional artisans have formed the backbone of Italy's economy. But with a prolonged recession and competition from Asia, many of those small companies have fallen on hard times. As Megan Williams reports, some are turning to high tech to help keep their traditions alive.
Buongiorno.
Piacere, piacere.
This tiny shop off a quiet canal in Venice is a showcase of shoemaking jewels. Dozens of gleaming pairs of handcrafted shoes in brown, greens, blues, and reds line the walls.
Here you can see the stitching from the wall to the sole.
Renowned Italian cobbler Simone Segalin shows me one of the pairs. He and five other craftspeople sew by hand.
My sector starting from my grandfather, so almost a century ago. It's a really particular and artisan work. It's totally manual and really handcrafted, this one.
The quality has attracted some top customers.
The Pope. We have the Pope, really.
Which Pope?
Wojtyla.
John Paul II.
We had Agnelli like a customer.
But after more than 100 years of top quality shoemaking, 7 years ago, Segalin had to turn to high tech to keep his business alive. With the global economic recession, Italy's northeast industrial sector shed 135,000 jobs, almost 20% of its total workforce. Segalin had to find ways to keep his prices down, so he risked investing in a costly laser scanner that gave a precise 3D printout of his client's feet.
And I import his foot, like I have a part of him. I have really take a part of him inside my database. And in that form, shape, I can build the shoes.
That move, says Segalin, not only eliminated having to rework shoes after measuring tape mistakes, but it also allowed his workshop to produce 3D printouts of the shoes before they're made for customers to see.
I think it's the future. I think technology is the elevator for small businesses.
Segalin says without the combination of tradition and high tech, the backbone of Italy's economy would collapse.
Italy is made of small and medium company, okay? So we are losing all the makers. We are losing all the makers. The skill of the makers, yes. Everybody is moving to the bigger company.
It's not just cobblers using 3D to save artisanal work.
This is a big necklace.
So that would be heavy if it were metal.
Yeah.
Giulia Favoretto of Ex Novo Jewelry Designs in Trento shows me necklaces, lamps, and funky glass frames with changeable parts, all adapted by distinguished Italian jewelry designers who usually work in gold and bronze, but now design for 3D printing.
These are wild. I love these.
The name is Cambiami, that means change me.
The small factory in the northern Italian province of Trentino mainly produces car parts for Fiat, Ferrari, and other European makes. But as a way to diversify and to make use of the artisanal traditions in the area, it's turned to designing decorative objects. The artisans sketch the model, then refine it on a computer. The jewelry is then printed here in the factory by specialized technicians. They clean off the powdery residue, polish and refine the objects, then dye and hand finish again, a process that takes 2 days.
C'è stato un crollo verticale con la crisi.
The jewelry and lamp designs represent a kind of renaissance for owner Ignazio Pomini. He says the recession put his whole company at risk about 10 years ago, including plans to develop designer products. When it pulled out of the worst of the crisis, he decided to develop 2 lines, the car parts and the 3D jewelry and lamp designs, inspired by Italian Renaissance architect and also goldsmith Filippo Brunelleschi. Pomini was the first Italian to buy a 3D printer.
È stata determinante perché
He says his investment in combining the designer work with the printing has paid off the most. And now he sends the creations to museums and jewelry stores around the world. He says the first few years were touch and go before we convinced people these were worthy objects. But, he adds, the potential has proven huge.
Coraggiosa, perché si tratta sempre di...
It just took a little courage, he says. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Trento, Northern Italy.
And that's it for today. The program is produced with help from Helen Sini. The sound engineer is Jürgen Kuhn, and I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to email the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is europe@dw.com. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.